Heute zu Gast der Gründer von Airbnb, Nathan Blicharczyk.
Everybody in the world was watching what was happening in Ukraine and was horrified. And so many people wanted to get involved. Many people didn't know how, though. So when they got this prompt from Airbnb that they could, you know, play a meaningful role in helping an individual by opting in to this program, many people did. And in fact, we've housed more than 130,000 people fleeing from Ukraine to date, all in a very short period of time. And it's a very unique ability. You know, I can't think of any other government or nonprofit that would have the capability to have so many people in such a short period of time.
Let's go! Go!
Herzlich willkommen beim OMR Podcast mit Philipp Westermeier.
Es folgt ein kurzer Hinweis für alle OMR-Festivalbesucher, insbesondere die, die im B2B- oder Industriekosmos aktiv sind. Wie ja alle Podcast-StammhörerInnen wissen, nutzen wir bei OMR schon seit längerem SalesViewer und weisen ja auch gerne hier darauf hin. Damit generieren wir wirklich zahlreiche B2B-Leads für uns und unsere verschiedenen Aktivitäten. Wer bislang SalesViewer noch nicht genauer selber unter die Lupe nehmen konnte, der kann das jetzt demnächst nämlich auf dem Festival tun. Und zwar gibt es dort einen Gemeinschaftsstand von SalesViewer mit OMR Reviews, wo unter anderem auch der neue OMR Viewer präsentiert wird. Ein Tool für unsere Kunden von OMR Reviews. Das Ganze findet statt in der Halle A1 am Stand C11. Und noch mehr SalesViewer am zweiten Eventtag spricht der Gründer von SalesViewer, der Benny, auf der Blue Stage über spannende B2B Best Practices. Also da kann man auch nochmal SalesViewer kennenlernen. Ansonsten natürlich alle Infos im Netz oder in Halle A1 am Stand C11. Zurück zum Podcast. Eigentlich machen wir englischsprachige Podcasts hier eher selten oder eigentlich auch gar nicht. Es sei denn, es kommen ganz ungewöhnliche, besonders herausragende Persönlichkeiten. Es ist einfach so, dass die Zahlen uns sagen, dass euch englischsprachige Podcasts scheinbar nicht so gut gefallen. Also sie werden zumindest nicht so gut gehört wie deutschsprachige. Aber es gibt halt diese Ausnahmen und jetzt war mal wieder so eine Ausnahme. Ähnlich wie vor kurzem mal bei Slack oder bei Snap. Wenn wir dann halt mit den ganz relevanten Persönlichkeiten aus der Digitalwelt sprechen können, dann wollen wir es halt doch nutzen. Und jetzt geht es halt um Airbnb, eine der spannendsten Digitalplattformen der Welt. Und insbesondere finde ich die persönlich deswegen spannend, nicht weil sie groß ist und erfolgreich das auch, aber weil sie auch einen sehr, sehr eigenen Weg gehen, wie sie die Marke führen, wie sie versuchen, auch sich zum Teil zu engagieren, rund um den Ukraine-Krieg oder Naturkatastrophen. Aber generell, auch während der Pandemie zum Beispiel, war das zu sehen, wie sie versuchen, aus ihrer Chance, so eine große Plattform führen zu dürfen, einfach mehr machen wollen. Das, finde ich, ist bei Airbnb mit am greifbarsten von allen Firmen, auf die ich so gucken kann, weltweit. Und deswegen war ich halt besonders happy, den Nathan zu haben. Nicht nur, um die ganze Geschichte einmal zu verstehen, wo kommen die eigentlich her. Natürlich auch die Anfänge, der Kampf hier in Europa gegen Vimdu ja zum Beispiel, der legendär damals aus dem Rocket-Internet-Inkubator kam ja Vimdu raus und sah dann eine Zeit lang sogar besser und erfolgreicher aus als Airbnb. Am Ende hätte dann Airbnb die Chance auch gehabt, Vimdu zu kaufen, haben sie nicht gemacht. Haben wir darüber gesprochen, recht ausführlich sogar. Aber am Ende vor allen Dingen auf diesen Punkt zu kommen, was man halt mit so einer Plattform machen kann. Es gibt ja auch viele Beispiele, wo man das Gefühl hat, zumindest hier in Deutschland, auch in den Medien, diese Plattformen werden nicht optimal geführt und das ja auch sehr viel Irritation auslöst, was so Plattformen tun. Sicherlich ist Airbnb da jetzt auch keine klassische Kommunikationsplattform, aber es ist irgendwo eine Community, darüber haben wir gesprochen. Und die versuchen halt, diese Plattform ja sehr positiv aufzuladen. Finde ich interessant. Kann man auch sagen, natürlich, die haben auch sehr viel Regulierungsbarrieren erstmal durchbrechen müssen oder auch ja da sehr viel Gegenwind gehabt oder haben den auch zu Recht zum Teil von Städten, wo dann auf einmal alle Menschen bei Airbnb nur noch vermieten. Auch darüber haben wir gesprochen. Es gab also sehr viele Themen und deswegen direkt rein ins Gespräch mit Nathan. Beziehungsweise noch ganz kurz ein Hinweis, und zwar, wer jetzt sagt, hey Mensch, das stimmt doch gar nicht, ich höre sehr gerne englischsprachige OMR-Podcasts, da der Hinweis, wir haben natürlich auch einen eigenen Kanal dafür, der heißt OMR Podcast International und den führt meistens mein Kollege Scott Peterson und der hat da zuletzt gehabt, den Gründer von Hinge oder von Allbirds, also wer sagt, okay, ich könnte das auch noch mehr häufiger vertragen und auch die alten Folgen von Westermeier auf Englisch, die finde ich interessant, der geht da bitte hin, OMR Podcast International, würden wir uns freuen, ansonsten jetzt aber los. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be on.
I skipped your last name because I was afraid I would maybe mispronounce it. How do you pronounce it?
Great question. Blicharczyk.
It's quite complicated.
Polish.
Let's talk a little bit about the beginnings of Airbnb. Everybody knows the brand now. Give us like a very quick rundown of like your first or like your current memories of how it all started.
Yes. Well, we were really just trying to solve our own problem. There were three of us living in an apartment in San Francisco. This is back in 2007. And one day the rent on the apartment was raised 25%. And I said, that's too expensive. I'm moving out of here. But my two flatmates wanted to stay, but they had just quit their jobs to become entrepreneurs, also known as unemployed. So they didn't have enough money to pay the rent either. But they're both designers by background. And they saw that a design conference was coming to San Francisco. And they noticed that all the hotels were sold out. So they had an idea. Why not rent out that extra bedroom to designers who might need a place to stay? Now, the bedroom was empty. I had even taken my bed with me. But they set up an airbed. And instead of calling it a bed and breakfast, they called it an airbed and breakfast. So Airbnb is short for airbed and breakfast. And they thought that maybe guys like themselves might want to stay there. So 25-year-old male. And instead, they got three different people to stay. One was a 35-year-old woman from Boston. Another was a father of four from Utah, a very rural area. And then there was a man from India. So a very diverse, eclectic crowd stayed there, paying $80 a night. They each stayed about four nights. So this is, three people times $80 a night times four nights, almost $1,000. So that meaningfully helped Joe and Brian pay the rent on the apartment that month. The guests had an affordable place to stay. And they all went to the conference together and had a really good time. And Joe and Brian introduced the guests to their friends. And so it was really actually a social experience as well. And so coming out of this, we thought, wow, that's really was a win-win. Maybe we can do this for other people and other situations. Maybe we can make it just as easy to book someone's home as a hotel. And so that's what we set out to do in early 2008. And now it's been almost 15 years, a little more than 15 years.
I mean, you were not the only ones that had this idea. I mean, it's not like renting out rooms or, in this case, an airbed. It was like very unique and the first time somebody thought of this at the time. And the internet was already there for like almost 15 years. And to this day, I wonder, why was it your business? Why was it the brand Airbnb that like penetrated the whole industry and became this global superstar brand? What did you do differently?
Yeah, certainly. There were, vacation rentals for, decades prior to Airbnb. And there were classified sites online that featured them. There was a service called Couchsurfing that was, very much kind of like, extra rooms or couches. So what did we do different? And I think what we did differently was innovate around trust. That's what allowed this to become mainstream and really scale around the globe, figuring out the trust challenge. Because everyone would say, how can I trust a stranger in my home? That was preventing a lot of people from participating. And we answered that question with three kind of original innovations. One was making sure that there were very rich user profiles so that you had a good sense of who was the person behind the room, who is providing the service, who's going to host you. So you'd see their picture, you'd see kind of where they work, a lot about them. So it wasn't anonymous. You got a sense of the identity. The second was facilitating the payments. So rather than exchanging money offline or wiring money directly to the landlord or the host, it would all go through Airbnb's payment platform, just like booking, a hotel today online. So, you pay Airbnb at the time of booking. Airbnb holds your money until after you arrive. Only then do we release it to the host. That way, if you need to cancel, you just call us. We can return the money. Or if you show up and something's not as described, that's unlikely. But if that were to happen, again, you can call us and we can return your money. The host knows that they have to deliver on what was promised in order to get paid. So this creates the right incentives as well. And then finally, the third feature that created the trust was the review system. After each day, the guest reviews the host reviews the guest. Both parties accumulate reputation over time. And now if you go to Airbnb, you'll see that like most homes have dozens and dozens of reviews. And this really lends credibility because it's a 360 perspective of the property. And this applies to guests too, of course. And these reviews are left by people who actually stayed there, who actually spent money. And so they're very credible reviews. So these three innovations were the original innovations. Over time, we've added a lot to that to make people feel comfortable staying in other people's homes and hosting and having this become a mainstream phenomenon. Indeed, there's now been 1.4 billion guest arrivals over the last 15 years from that modest beginning 15 years ago.
Somebody must have believed in those three aspects. I mean, given that there were a couple competitors or other services at the time, you were able to raise a lot of money. How much money did you take in at Airbnb like over the whole 15 years now? How much was that? How much did it cost to build Airbnb?
Well, it ultimately added up to a lot of money, roughly $3 billion. But we started very slow, to be honest. The first year, actually, no investors were even willing to give us any money whatsoever. And then our first fundraising, our seed round, was only $600,000. And from there, the next round was $7 million. And then it started getting more serious and bigger numbers starting in 2011 when we became a global company. Then it became much more expensive to grow the company. But in the beginning, it was very organic. And, you know, we were basically establishing our credibility, building this trust, building our community.
Today, you're releasing a couple of new features, and I was able to look at some of the new features that you released. And some of them give me the feeling that you navigate towards a little bit of towards a social network almost. I mean, the user profiles, the deep profiling that you mentioned already. Do you perceive yourself as some sort of social network?
Well, I think when Airbnb is at its best, we are connecting people to other people, such as the hosts, but it could be other guests in the future. And it is also to the places where they're visiting, right? I think we allow people to have a different kind of travel experience that ultimately allows them to feel like they belong in these local communities and get off the beaten track and discover the hidden gems. And so I think at the best, you know, Airbnb is about connection. And with the release this week, the launch of Airbnb Rooms. So these are rooms being offered in people's homes while the host is present. This is how Airbnb started. This is what Joe, Brian, and I did in the very beginning. And so we've offered it over the last 15 years. But during the pandemic, you know, for obvious reasons, this category of property was less popular. You know, people wanted the social distance. But coming out of the pandemic, we think that there is a craving to reconnect with people, whether those be friends or new people as well. And we also see that now that times are less economically certain with inflation, with the possibility of a recession, we know that people are more price conscious. And what's the amazing thing about these rooms is we have 1 million of them on our website, and 80% of them are less than $100 per night. The average price is $67. Per night. So they're very affordable. But beyond the affordability aspect is the connection aspect, the opportunity to meet someone new, even briefly. I actually stayed in one of these just last week. It was so nice to arrive in the evening and have a light on in the house and, you know, have someone to greet me at the door. And her dog was there.
And then
like
you stayed at the room.
You stayed in the room.
Did that person know that you're the founder of Airbnb?
She knew that I was a host. So she had looked at my profile and learned enough about me to know that I was an active host. But she didn't put two and two together to realize I was the original host or one of the original hosts. So we had a nice conversation about hosting and my hosting experience in San Francisco. But I don't think she realized that I was actually the founder of the company.
And she never did. I mean, for the whole duration of your stay, she never realized?
Well, I was only there for one night. So, okay. we probably conversed for 10 or 15 minutes and then I adjourned for the evening and I was gone the next day. What my point is though, not only is Airbnb Rooms affordable, but it can be really nice to connect with another individual and have a conversation as a part of your stay.
How many nights do you stay in Airbnbs elsewhere in a year?
Well, I mean, I've stayed in obviously hundreds and hundreds over the last 15 years. I was just got back last night from a trip to Washington, D.C., where I spent four nights in an Airbnb, and I was there 2.5 weeks ago, where I spent another five nights there. So it's a little hard to estimate, but I could easily suspect, 30 days a year, maybe more. I'm also an active host, So
I know. I was going to ask you.
And I'm hosting too. So I'm on both sides of the equation.
So you're having like two guests over then now while we speak?
No, I'm not hosting tonight, actually. Most of my hosting activity is in the summer right now. So I'll be gearing up for that June, July, and August. I don't have anyone here right now.
I was asking you the social network question because I wanted to understand the growth. I mean, you described the trust factor and the differentiation that you focused on, but like still 15 years from zero to a global brand. And I mean, you're probably more famous or for at least more known than any hotel brand or any other travel brand in general, almost. What was the magic sauce for that? I mean, was there like some growth hack or a couple of them? What like gave you this acceleration?
Well, I think ultimately it's the benefit of doing something different. We created a new category of travel. And while there were vacation rentals before, we increased the scale by an order of magnitude, to say the least, and expanded the category because, look, most people on our platform are individuals. These are primary homes. These are extra bedrooms. Some of them are second homes. So there's just a much wider variety of accommodation you can find as a result of Airbnb. And I think the net effect of that is, these properties have a lot of character. And you can find them literally anywhere now, 220 countries and territories, 100,000 different cities. I think we just expanded people's imagination for what it can mean to travel. When you travel, the accommodation can, really shape your experience. Whether that means you're meeting a host or you're staying in a neighborhood you wouldn't otherwise have stayed in, or the home itself is part of the experience because of, the character of the property. And so I think, travel is something that I think most people aspire to do and really enjoy. And people love to talk about afterwards. And Airbnb really played a pivotal role and does play a pivotal role in people's travel experiences. So when they're telling their stories after the fact about their travels, Airbnb inevitably comes up in the conversation and that gets shared with friends and family. And what better way to learn about Airbnb than from someone you trust? Because ultimately it does require a great deal of trust to use Airbnb. And so I think we find it most effective when people learn about the company and the experience through a friend or family member.
So to put it in marketing or business terms, word of mouth and user references was like a key growth driver.
Word of mouth by far was key. And basically that positive kind of testimonial from friends and family is what drove it. And had to, it's probably the only thing that could have driven it for us because, again, it requires a great deal of trust. And traditional marketing can create some awareness, but doesn't always necessarily create that level of trust that you get when you hear it from someone you know.
Das größte Problem von Computern und digitaler Technologie sitzt häufig vor der Screen und macht Fehler. So auch Menschen bei uns, so auch ich, so auch ihr. Und zwar häufig, indem ihr einfach nur auf bös gemeinte Attacken reinfallt. Und davor schützt euch ein neues, demnächst vielleicht Unicorn aus Köln. Die Rede ist vom Cybersecurity-Unternehmen SoSafe, die euch, die eure Belegschaft, die eure Kolleginnen und Kollegen, die Firmen und Systeme davor schützen, dass andere Menschen häufig mit KI-generierte Mails versenden, mit zum Beispiel so Betreffzeilen wie jetzt Login-Daten ändern für neues Kundentool oder Cloud-Account wurde deaktiviert, hier klicken oder. Ihr wisst, was ich meine. 85% aller Cyberattacken auf Firmen sind deswegen erfolgreich, weil Menschen auf Sachen reingefallen sind. Und genau davor schützt SoSafe, indem sie Angriffssimulationen fahren, indem sie Risikoanalysen durchführen, indem sie eine Human Firewall in eurer Firma aufbauen, so nennen sie das. Und sie machen allen Hörerinnen und Hörern folgendes Angebot. Ihr könnt euch selber attackieren lassen, natürlich ohne Risiko und Gefahr, um zu testen, wie sicher eure Systeme sind. Alles kostenlos, um SoSafe kennenzulernen. Übrigens, die durchschnittliche Klickrate von Leuten auf Attacken von SoSafe liegt bei 30%. Gerne rausfinden, wo eure liegt und feststellen, wie hoch die Gefahr ist. SoSafe. .de/OMR hilft da sehr. Nochmal, SO, safe, ein Wort, SoSafe.de/OMR. Zurück zum Podcast. And I thought, like, maybe it's, it plays into the same logic, but I thought that you had a lot of communication ideas, a lot of weird locations, a lot of unusual places listed, and that would always produce press, 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 press. I mean, there was years when I was, I'm reading a lot of news and a lot of magazines. Airbnb was all over the place because you came up with, like, unusual content, if you want. Was that part of your strategy?
Yes, I think, you know, we have such a diversity of properties, and some of them are just so fun to just even look through the pictures of. And I think what we learned is that you could create stories just about the properties themselves, and that, you know, really leading with the properties and the stories was a very effective way to engage people. And so, you know, we've done that just with properties that are very interesting to begin with, but we've also done that in terms of plugging into pop culture and iconic properties that are well known. I know we did one of these lately in Germany. I think there's a new series on Netflix. The name is escaping me offhand, but the palace, I think the program's called The Empress on Netflix, mm-hmm. but the palace featured there is for a limited time available on Airbnb. And so, you know, we find these ways to plug into, like, what's happening, you know, in terms of the conversation externally. And then we plug Airbnb into that in ways that, you know, remind people that you can pretty much find anything on Airbnb.
Give me some examples or anecdotal evidence of the best properties, the best ideas that you came up with. I mean, I think the White House wasn't among the locations, but anything, what was most, like, what did work best?
You know, again, we have these things that you can never imagine being on Airbnb. There's a potato in Idaho, you know, as an example. Tree houses is probably just the most general category that always engages people and has the highest kind of conversion rate. In terms of, you know, social culture and pop culture, we got the Home Alone house on Airbnb briefly. We did something with Blockbuster. Blockbuster obviously no longer exists, the movie rental company, but we found one of their stores that still exists somewhere and allowed you to kind of sleep there. We have worked with airlines to take their one of their airplanes and turn it into a suite for the night. So, you know, we've gotten very creative to partner with companies or some of these iconic kind of cultural references and, you know, plug into that to tell our story.
Did you notice that during your growth period, I think it was around like 2014, 15, there was like German companies trying to copy the model and like being earlier than you here in Europe and in Germany, like we had one called Vimdu. And did you notice them at all?
Oh, I certainly noticed. Yes, of course. Look, that actually started in 2011.
Okay.
And, you know, it was a scary time for us, to be honest, because at the start of 2011, we were a small company. We were 40 people. They were all based in San Francisco. And most of our community was in North America. We had a small European host community, but it was in its early days. And, you know, suddenly Wimdu and there was another company too kind of emerged kind of out of
nowhere.
Nine
Flats, I think it was. Nine Flats.
Yeah, that was the other one. You're right. You've done your homework. These companies don't exist anymore. But back then, they were a real threat because they were run by very credible serial entrepreneurs who had access to large teams that were ready to go, raised a lot of funding. And so I remember Wimdu, you know, in 2011, we went to visit them, you know, halfway through the year just to have some initial conversations. And, you know, they claimed to have 400 employees. We had 40. and, you know, we raised $100 million and then they raised $100 million a week later. And so, you know, it felt like there was going to be a big battle. I think ultimately what we realized was we had very different tactics. We had obviously been building this business for a few years and it was growing through word of mouth and positive experiences. And, you know, we had a real genuine community. And, you know, these companies that were started very quickly and trying to scale very quickly took a different approach to scale. They had effectively sales teams that were trying to reach out and bring on hosts, in particular, our own, the Airbnb hosts, where they were trying to recruit to their own platform. But ultimately, those efforts, those sales efforts were very transactional. You know, they would incentivize hosts to join the platform. But, you know, the product wasn't quite there yet. The community didn't yet exist. And because people weren't learning about it through word of mouth and through their friends, and instead they were learning about it through a salesperson, you know, I don't think it really stuck. There was, you know, some initial numbers that might have looked very impressive, but ultimately it wasn't, it wasn't recurring in terms of the growth of the community. It was kind of a flash in the pan. And so it's a very different business model than other companies at the time. I think, you know, the tactics that were used by these European companies were very similar to what Groupon had done, a year or two before, which was, again, very sales-driven and I think effective for them at that time. But that kind of model doesn't work when you're trying to build a community and where the activity is people-to-people and really built on trust. And so I think that's ultimately what contributed to our success. And within about 2 years, it was clear that, you know, Airbnb was going to be, the service of most popularity in Europe, and the other companies began to fall away.
And I think you made the decision to not purchase them or not, you know, take them over. And instead, you had some German entrepreneurs that worked freelance for you that you took on, and that you gave them some shares, and they tried to like establish Airbnb in Germany, right? I mean, that was the approach that you took. I remember that at the time there was like a couple of people that all of a sudden, like major names in the German industry, all of a sudden worked for Airbnb.
Right. So, yes, at that time in 2011, we were approached as to whether, you know, we should partner with these companies, and we had to entertain it as it was, you know, a very credible offer. And so we thought about it. I think ultimately what we realized, going back to what I said before, was that, we felt that we, meaning Airbnb, were missionaries. We really believed in building community and connecting people. We were users of the product, and we really wanted to think long-term about how we built the company. And, you know, what we felt was that these other companies who were, you know, very new to this, felt a little bit more like mercenaries, in that these were entrepreneurs who saw a hot business model and were looking to replicate it as quickly as possible, but not necessarily in a way that was sticky, and, you know, not one that really, you know, was deeply invested in creating the kind of trust and community that we were working to create. And so we felt like, you know, ultimately we had a different understanding about how to build the business, and we wanted to kind of do it our way. Now, if we work on a partner and do this together, then we had to come up with a plan B. And so in order to do that, we wanted to make sure that, we were just as local in Europe as our European competitors. They were obviously started in Europe, but travel's inherently global, and we knew it was important to be, very present in Europe, and we want to be just as local. And so to do that, we opened offices in all the major countries and kind of capital cities across Europe. And so in a span of about 6 months, we opened about 8 offices across Europe, and we recruited teams and hired country managers. And these offices, you know, are still there today and have, you know, meaningful teams behind them. But that is how we became just as local as our competitors, and was part of why we, I think, were successful in Europe and then ultimately globally.
One thing I noticed with this example or in general is that you didn't focus that much on performance marketing. I remember the Vimdu guys and the whole, at the time, everything was about SEO and paid advertising, and they... German companies are generally good at that. They're really like smart at paid marketing and all these activities. And it seemed like you didn't focus on that too much. You focused on the product. And even like now it feels like you don't even do like paid marketing. I mean, paid advertising is not a big category to you, at least it seems.
Yeah, we actually probably do less paid marketing now and performance marketing now than we did earlier on. You're right. Performance marketing was never core to how we grew the community. It's not how we scaled it. Frankly, that'd be a very expensive proposition. The way we did use performance marketing, though, and we did use it, and it was important, was very strategically to establish supply and demand early on, especially when we were bootstrapping the marketplace, right? Airbnb is a two-sided marketplace. in order to have bookings, you need to have a certain amount of supply, meaning homes. And for you to have a certain number of homes, there needs to be a certain amount of demand to create people being interested. And so you have this dynamic in the beginning where you're trying to bootstrap the marketplace and you have to have a critical mass of both demand and supply. And so we early on discovered how to use performance marketing to recruit a critical mass of homes and travelers in a specific geography. Because one of the amazing things about performance marketing is it's hyper-targeted. So we could say something like, hey, in Paris or in, you know, a smaller town, say Strasbourg, we need to recruit 300 homes. We knew that early on, if you had 300 homes, 100 of which were reviewed, that was kind of a critical mass of inventory to make it an interesting consumer experience. And so we would set up campaigns to recruit hosts trying to achieve that critical mass. And it would be inefficient at first, of course, but that's the price you have to pay in order to build that initial critical mass. And so we would do that for a little bit. And then simultaneously, we'd bring in the demand paired with the supply to basically drive those initial reviews that you needed to get on the homes. And the ultimate goal was that once you had a critical mass of supply with reviews, because you had driven a little bit of demand to it, then you had an interesting marketplace in that city, in that geography. And that after that, it would become a flywheel and conversion rate would be high and it would kind of grow on its own. And so we very much use performance marketing to bootstrap the marketplace, but not to scale the marketplace. And that's why today we're not reliant at all on performance marketing. It's, you know, the marketplace does the work on its own through word of mouth. But it was helpful in the beginning when we were bootstrapping it.
Do you look at your markets in terms of cities or countries or neighborhoods? Like, how precisely do you cut down your market and decide like where to act and how to act differently?
Well, it really depended on the stage of the company, right? In the early days, we very much looked at it city by city. And we thought, you know, travel is inherently global. And so to be an interesting travel platform, you really need to have accommodation in the important travel markets around the world. And those are well known, right? You can generate a list of those based on travel industry data, number of hotel rooms by city, et cetera. So, you know, we had a list of 200, even 1,000 different cities ranked, and we'd work our way down the list trying to make sure that we had enough homes in each of these places. And we'd look at the conversion rate of each of them and, you know, try to tune supply and demand using performance marketing and other tactics to make that market efficient and thriving. That's what we did in the early days. Now, if you fast forward to today, we very much think about it at a country level because, you know, we have a very robust marketplace in each of these cities. We don't have to be as granular. We think about, you know, country level investment. And again, we do a lot less performance marketing now. We do a lot more kind of brand marketing, still not much marketing in the grand scheme of things. But when we do marketing, it's more brand oriented. And, you know, it's based on, you know, what is the awareness of Airbnb in the market? And also, we do it in conjunction with the product features that we're launching. We view the marketing as an opportunity to explain the newest features of the product because there is a lot of, I think, latent understanding of what Airbnb is. And the marketing is really an opportunity to explain, you know, what's new about the latest offering.
Can you break down the cities in order of importance? I mean, what cities are most important to Airbnb? I mean, is it New York? Is it Paris? What city? Like, is there a city maybe that has like more than 5% of your revenue?
No, there actually isn't. There's no city that has 5% or even 4 or 3%. And that's one of the amazing things, I think, is that we're in 100,000 different cities and towns across the world. And so no one city is plays that big a role. It is a very diffuse business. And over the course of the pandemic, it only got more diffuse because we saw travel change. We saw that people were no longer going to top destinations, international destinations, big cities. Instead, they wanted to go to rural areas, often nearby rural destinations. And so, you know, even more than ever, we saw this long tail expand in our business diversify.
And can you give me any city that's the most important? Like, what's the biggest city for you?
I don't have the latest numbers offhand, but you know, the biggest cities would reflect kind of the global trends that you see. So popular international destinations, it'd be places like Paris, London, New York, these sorts of places. But that being said, I think, again, one of the things that we've realized that is unique about Airbnb is our ability to diffuse tourism into other destinations, which is not just strategic for us, because there's only so much, homes in some of these places and accommodation. But it's also something that, as we work with governments, they're very interested in doing, because tourism is a very powerful driver of the economy. And, you know, governments want to make sure that it's not completely concentrated, that, you know, all the different cities and towns in their countries are benefiting. And so one of the ways in which we did this over the pandemic was create something called Airbnb Categories, which is a way to explore and discover places that you might not originally have thought to travel to based on how might be a great Airbnb there. So instead of any travel site, usually you go there and the first question they ask you is, where do you want to go? And you can't really see any product, any accommodation until you answer that question. Now on Airbnb, you go there and we have these categories. So instead of saying you want to go to Paris or wherever, you can click one of these categories. And one of my favorite categories is OMG. It stands for Oh My God. It's these things, places that you could never have imagined existed, or where you could never imagine it would be possible to stay. You click this category and you will be totally inspired by some of the places you can stay, and they'll show you on the map where they exist. And so you might say that I want to stay in this treehouse or this castle or whatever it may be. And I wasn't planning on going to this small town or village, but because this place is there, I now want to go to that destination, to that region. And we've seen the impact of this. We've seen how this has effectively taken people who would have otherwise gone to, you know, traditional city destinations, and now they're branching out and going to new destinations. And so I think it's really like one of the powerful roles that a platform can play is really shaping how, you know, consumers, think about what's possible, what products are, might be of interest to them.
Unser Partner, die TK, also die Techniker Krankenkasse, die haben neben vielen anderen Leistungen auch einen Preis, einen Award, den sie vergeben, gemeinsam mit dem Handelsblatt. Und zwar geht es darum, Firmen auszuzeichnen aus dem Gesundheitssegment. Startups, vor allen Dingen junge Firmen, die helfen dort, Innovationen reinzubringen, das Gesundheitssystem voranzubringen, zu digitalisieren möglichst. Wer so etwas macht von euch, wer zuhört, sagt, okay, ich habe eine junge Firma, ich bin genau in dem Bereich tätig, ihr könnt gewinnen. Ihr könnt beim sogenannten Health E Award gewinnen. Ihr müsst euch nur bewerben, bis zum 3. Mai geht das noch. Dann gibt es einen Preis, der wird verliehen hier in Hamburg am 10. Oktober. Man bekommt zum Beispiel ein Media- und Kommunikationspaket von OMR im Wert von 10.000 Euro, wenn man dort auf den ersten drei Plätzen liegt, und vieles mehr. Also ziemlich einfach teilzunehmen. Ihr müsst nur in dem Bereich tätig sein, Unterlagen einreichen, die sind aber relativ schlank. Alle Informationen dazu findet ihr natürlich auch in den Shownotes. Findet ihr auch unter health-i.de, also health-i.de, oder in einem extra dafür aufgeschriebenen Artikel auf omr.com. Haben meine Kollegen nochmal aufgeschrieben, wer zuletzt so gewonnen hat, was man da genau tun muss. Einfach googeln, OMR, Health-i, werdet ihr alles finden. Ich hoffe, wir sehen uns im Oktober bei der Preisverleihung hier in Hamburg auf der Bühne.
Zurück zum Podcast.
I mean, I was surprised when the Ukraine war started here in Europe, that there were so many homes in Ukraine. And I noticed they were there because there was all these charity and support movements where people from the US and other European countries tried to support Ukrainians by just submitting money to them without even staying there in their place, obviously, but like, you know, giving the money through their Airbnb accounts. And then also like people from the Ukraine came out of Ukraine and stayed somewhere right next to the border on the Polish side or on the German side, maybe. And it seemed like there's lots and lots of homes in Ukraine, more than I expected. Were you aware that was the case? And did you like focus on that? Or was that something that you try to push forward the whole support there, or was it just happen naturally on the platform?
Yeah, this is another great illustration of how powerful platforms can be and how they can be creatively used to address challenges. So we have this capability to reach out to our host community. We have more than 6 million homes on the Airbnb platform. And in times of crisis, where people are being displaced, we have built this capability to reach out to our hosts and ask them, would they like to help out during this time of need? Would they like to open up their home and host someone who's been displaced, either due to natural disaster, or in this case, due to war? And it's a capability that was first created in 2012 in response to a hurricane that occurred in New York. And the idea actually came from Twitter. We saw a Airbnb host who on Twitter was saying, I'm opening up my home free of charge to people displaced by the storm. You know, reach out to me. We were really inspired by this individual. And we thought, why don't we build this as a capability into our platform? Why don't we reach out to all our hosts in the area and ask them whether they would like to do the same thing? And we built this overnight. And literally within 24 hours, more than 1,000 New Yorkers raised their hand and said, I would like to open up my home and host people. And so that's how it got started. It's been over a decade now. Over this period, we've been making this capability more and more robust. And so what happened when the war in Ukraine broke out was within a week, we were able to reach out to our global community and ask, you know, who is willing to help out by opening up their home, either free of charge or at half price. And if it was at half price, then Airbnb.org, which is our nonprofit, would provide the funding to pay for that other half of the house. So in other words, the refugee from Ukraine does not pay anything. Airbnb.org steps in when necessary. But ultimately, a lot of generosity is coming from the host community. And this worked really well because everybody in the world was watching what was happening in Ukraine and was horrified. And so many people wanted to get involved. Many people didn't know how, though. So when they got this prompt from Airbnb that they could, you know, play a meaningful role in helping an individual by opting in to this program, many people did. And in fact, we've housed more than 130,000 people fleeing from Ukraine to date, all in a very short period of time. And it's a very unique ability. You know, I can't think of any other government or nonprofit that would have the capability to have so many people in such a short period of time. And so, you know, this again illustrates the power of a platform to mobilize a community to, you know, take productive action and really, you know, do something good.
Who do you see as your biggest competitor?
Well, we really don't think about that too often now because I think what we do is fairly distinct. And, you know, because of our global scale, you know, if you want to stay in a home, Airbnb is the place to go. Now, of course, travelers, you know, have a diversity of options in terms of accommodations. They can't stay at hotels, right? Many people do. And we have some hotels on the platform, but not many. And if you want a hotel, then you go to one of the traditional OTAs. You know, so I think when we think about that, it's all about reminding people the benefits of staying in a home, right? The charm, the character of the home, the fact that you can get multiple rooms in a home and have more space. You can have your own kitchen. If you're traveling with family, this is all really helpful to have, you know, space for everyone to sleep, but also have shared space where you can kind of come together. The fact that these homes exist at all price points. I talked earlier about the fact that Airbnb rooms, the average price is only $67 a night. And yet on the other hand of the spectrum, we do have luxury properties too. And so I think the important thing is that people remember Airbnb is not just one thing. It's this incredible spectrum of possibility. And I'd like to think that we have something for everyone. And so, you know, that's the message, you know, we really want to convey as we, you know, we think about all the options that people have and more traditional accommodation options.
What was most challenging? Obviously, the pandemic was quite challenging, but also I remember, I mean, you mentioned the competition in the early days. Also, some cities had a hard time allowing Airbnb, or still, like, some cities don't allow Airbnb to this day. During all this ride, this 15-year ride, what was most difficult for you to navigate?
Yeah, well, we were obviously doing something very novel, and that was never really contemplated. And so, you know, there was a lot of gray area. The existing regulation didn't speak explicitly to, you know, what Airbnb was. At first, when you're small, nobody cares. Nobody even wants to talk to you if you approach them government-wise, because there's other priorities. But of course, as Airbnb grew, governments took notice. And we always said from the beginning that, you know, we want to embrace regulation. To be regulated is to be recognized. And that's a commitment we made dating way back to probably 2013 or so, 2014, when some of the first regulations were being discussed in certain places. Now, if you fast forward to today and you look at Airbnb's top 200 markets, you know, 80% of them are regulated. And some of them have been regulated now for more than a decade. There is a lot of regulation in place. I think the key is that with regulation, you're striking a balance between, you know, putting boundaries and guardrails in place, while also trying to make sure that, the ordinary people who benefit most from this model can thrive. We know that 40 to 50% of our hosts tell us when we survey them that this income from Airbnb really helps them to, you know, afford basic living expenses. We know that, you know, 80% of our hosts are casual hosts listing, just their own property. That's the state of regulation.
Is there people that became millionaires or like millionaires a couple of times over by renting out stuff on Airbnb?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of success stories. I think our host community cumulatively over the last 15 years has earned $180 billion. I think the average host typically earns, roughly $8,000 per year. It varies by country, but that would be kind of the typical scenario. The regulation can put the boundaries on there to make sure that there isn't speculative activity happening if that's not what's desired. There are very traditional vacation destinations that, have a history going back many decades of second homes and things like that too. So, I think every city and town should figure out what's best for them. I think we're thinking about how do we effectively partner with these cities to help them regulate. And I think we've been very innovative here. We have created something we call City Portal, which is meant to be a one-stop shop for governments to help them deal with all the things that come up when thinking about Airbnb, whether it's data sharing, taxation, enforcement of permitting schemes, kind of neighbor noise issues, COVID when that was happening. So we've created a portal where governments can log in and have access to rich tooling that's integrated with our platform to more effectively work with Airbnb in their communities. And this product was informed based off of a lot of the one-off work we did over the last 10 years. Over the last 10 years, we've built more than 1,000 kind of custom bespoke products for various governments and a lot of the big cities around the world. And based on those learnings, we distilled it down into a common set of functionality that we can make available to any city, because we are in 100,000 different cities. And so we have to come up with scalable solutions. We have about 300 governments using this platform today, and it's growing very quickly. But one of the things I'm most proud of, just as an example, is how we've empowered local governments to collect tax on this activity. Typically, hotel tax or VAT, whatever's appropriate in their jurisdiction. But to date, more than $7 billion U.S. dollars in taxes have been collected through this platform, all automatically. This is frankly tax that local small town cities were not well equipped to collect because, again, it's based off activity coming from individuals. You know, it's very hard to manage that. This now all happens automatically through the platform. And I think it speaks to the potential to build powerful tools that, you know, take this very kind of casual activity and formalize it and make the right things happen in a way that's streamlined and easy for all parties.
Do you suffer from the fact that I think globally, Silicon Valley has changed its appearance or the perception of Silicon Valley has changed over the past years? It used to be like that positive future paradise place where the future is being shaped and everything is optimistic. And the past years, there came so many stories came out and so many, like now with even with the AI, like a new scary technology, everything seems a little more gray and a little more, is perceived a little more skeptical that comes out of Silicon Valley, at least here in Germany. And I think that's a danger or threat to your model because, I mean, Airbnb relies on being this positive company. Do you share my perspective or do you feel that as well? What's your take?
Well, I really don't think about us as a Silicon Valley company. I think about us as a global company. Again, I mentioned earlier, you know, we really wanted to be viewed as a local company. In all these countries that we operate, we have local teams there, we have local offices. And so although the innovation was birthed in Silicon Valley, and I'm here in San Francisco today talking to you, over the web, I think the way in which you operate and the way in which we think long-term is very much more of a global mindset and, you know, wanting to be a good partner with all the communities in which we operate. That's kind of where we are. I kind of hope that, especially after 15 years, that we've really kind of come into our own in terms of who we are and how people think about us and don't just lump us in with other companies.
But do you share the general perception? I mean, is the Silicon Valley as without Airbnb change? Is like, did the atmosphere change a little?
Well, you know, everything goes through cycles. And, I think we've had a decade of kind of boom, meaning companies that scaled very quickly and achieved great, great valuations. There was a bit of a reset during the pandemic as people adjust to changes in consumer behavior and just the maturing of the landscape in which some of these businesses operate. You know, whether that's, you know, crypto or kind of gig economy stuff and such. But look, I think AI in some ways represents a new possible wave. And although some are very fearful of this, and of course there needs to be guardrails, I think there's also a lot of hope and optimism that should be coming with this as well. Because ultimately, this is a very powerful tool that I think can do amazing things. And, you know, we should be cautious about, you know, using it the wrong way. But there are so many things that it could enable and so many new businesses that could be created based on this and innovation that could come as a second order effect of AI capabilities. So, you know, as an entrepreneur, you have to be optimistic because it's difficult to create new things and challenge the status quo. But I am truly optimistic about, you know, the potential for AI and also just innovation in general. Right. And look, Airbnb was founded in 2008, 2009 during the Great Recession. It was a time when there was not a lot of hope. There was a lot of fear, where it was very difficult to raise money. I told you earlier that our first round of fundraising was $600,000 for 20% of the company. That was a $3 million valuation.
Who gave you that check? Who gave you that check?
Sequoia Capital. You know,
wow.
The best firm in the world. But, you know, that kind of deal today would be unheard of. And so I say that to just say that, you know, when times are hard and people don't necessarily have hope, it can actually be some of the best times to start a company. And it's some of the periods in which the best innovation emerges. And so, look, I think we might be in one of those periods again.
All right. I know you got to go. There's, I think, another interview waiting. Thank you very much for taking the time and jumping on the call. Thank you very much, Nate.
Thanks for having me on the program. I enjoyed it.
Wir arbeiten derzeit wahrscheinlich schon mit fast 100 Leuten jeden Tag daran, am 7. und 8. Mai ein wirklich lehrreiches, informatives, produktives, lebenswertes OMR-Festival hinzustellen für alle, die kommen wollen. Und ihr seid alle herzlich eingeladen, da dabei zu sein. Natürlich. Aber ich weiß, es gibt ein Thema und das ist die Übernachtung hier in Hamburg. Mittlerweile sind Hotels doch teurer als normal. Deswegen haben wir gemeinsam mit der Wirtschaftsförderung Bremen und mit unserem Partner HRS uns etwas ausgedacht, und zwar Hotelkontingente in Bremen. Der Trick dabei ist, man ist in einer Stunde von Bremen aus wirklich direkt am Messegelände am Hamburger Dammtorbahnhof. Deswegen könnte man ruhig auch günstig in Bremen übernachten und dann pendeln. Das ist unproblematisch. Eine Stunde vom Dammtor aus sind es nur noch wenige Schritte zum Messegelände. Wer die Hotelpreise dort einmal auschecken möchte, findet alle Infos unter hrs.de/omr-bre wie Bremen. hrs.de/omr-bre. Wer sich jetzt fragt, okay, wer sind denn diese Wirtschaftsförderer in Bremen, die das mit möglich machen, der findet alle Infos über den Wirtschaftsstandort Bremen, über die Wirtschaftsförderung Bremen unter wfb-bremen.de. Zurück zum Podcast.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars. Bei OMR.